This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. A recent Pew Research Center poll found that a majority of bisexuals were in the closet, reluctant to reveal the truth about their sexual attractions to the important people in their lives. It was particularly true of men. There are some enduring stereotypes about bisexuality among heterosexuals and homosexuals. It's a sign of being oversexed, of being sexually confused, of going through a phase, of copping out, of somehow being illegitimate or less than. We wanted to explore the issue, and we have three guests who are joining us today on Radio Times. I should add this is an adult conversation, probably not appropriate for young children. Brian Dodge is Associate Professor in the Department of Applied Health Science and Associate Director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. And Brian Dodge, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Vanessa Schick, and she's Assistant Professor in the Division of Management Policy and Public Health at the University of Texas School of Public Health. And Vanessa Schick joining us by telephone. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Rand Faulkner. He's a clinical social worker at the Mazzoni Center in Philadelphia, and that's a nonprofit organization that provides services to the LGBT community. And Rand Faulkner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you, all three of you here on Radio Times. And Brian, let me begin with you. Help us understand the stigma or perhaps even the biphobia that you have done some research on. What is that about?
Well, let me start out by saying that it's nothing new. I'd be remiss if I started a conversation like this being here at the campus of Indiana University in Bloomington without quoting Alfred Kinsey. And you may know Alfred Kinsey
Sure.
did some of the first early scientific studies of sexual behavior in the United States. And my colleagues and I were fortunate enough to work on a paper a couple years back with Paul Gephardt, who is the last surviving member of Kinsey's original research team. And in that paper, we were going through the original volumes of the Kinsey reports. And I came across this passage that I think pretty much sums up not only bisexuality, but sexuality in general. Mm-hmm. And he's talking in the male volume here. So he says, males do not represent two discrete populations, heterosexual and homosexual. The world is not divided into sheep and goats. Not all things are black, nor all things white. It is a fundamental of human taxonomy that nature rarely deals with discrete categories. Only the human mind invents categories and tries to force facts into separated pigeonholes. The living world is a continuum in each and every one of its aspects. The sooner we learn this concerning human sexual behavior, the sooner we shall reach a sound understanding of the realities of sex. And again, that was in 1948. And I think just that we're still having this conversation in 2013. And, you know, thanks, Susan, for helping to set up, you know, having me on today. But when she and I were talking on the phone yesterday just about the show, we had, you know, discussed about these recent headlines that, you know, were in the media lately with, you know, new person comes out as bisexual, this new, you know, topic or phenomenon, bisexuality. And it's really interesting because, you know, look back in the mid-90s, Newsweek published a cover story on bisexuality that called it the new sexual orientation. In the 70s, New York Times had an article, Bisexual Chic, Anything Goes, talking about this new trend. And I think in a way, just the fact that we keep coming back to this as something new, which looking back to antiquity and ancient Greece and cultures around the world where bisexuality has been experienced and expressed, you know, throughout time, just lends to some of the stereotypes and the sort of misunderstandings that we have in our society when
let me just stop you there because you put a lot on the table there, and I do want to get to that's okay. Let me get Vanessa and Rand into the conversation as well. And it's interesting that we're not talking about anything new today in Radio Times. But Vanessa, help us understand, I guess, the sort of visceral, even negative reaction that bisexuality has, I guess, gotten over the years.
I think that there's a lot of misperceptions around bisexuality, a number of which you named just a few minutes ago. there's particularly, and I'm going to kind of focus on bisexual women,
right,
because that's most of the area that I do research. But I think that there's kind of two overarching stereotypes. One being that it's just a phase,
right,
that bisexuality is kind of a holding place while somebody decides what their quote-unquote true sexual identity is. And I think part of the reason there's that perception is that bisexual men and women, like all people, at some points in their life may find themselves, in a monogamous relationship. And when they do, what people assume from that relationship is, oh, that person was never truly bisexual. They're either heterosexual or homosexual. So it's really people's assumptions about how people think, feel, or believe, and their misperceptions about that, that lead to kind of this invisibility around bisexuality that perpetuate these stereotypes.
Well, and picking up on what both of Vanessa and Brian were saying, Rand, to you, this sexual continuum, that there is this continuum, and obviously if we're talking about bisexuality, we're talking about somehow people in the middle of this continuum.
Right, right. Well, there's a middle, and there's several different places, I think, in that continuum. There's a middle, which I think is maybe very rare. I think that's what some of the literature has found, that a truly bisexual man is rare,
mm-hmm,
and there's going to be many different variations on this continuum.
And it's rare because?
Because, who knows? I don't really know myself why it's rare. I feel like, the way we relate to other people plays a big part into it. I think society plays a big part into it, but I think that why it's rare, I don't think is really known at this point. I don't know that answer, at least.
Well, Brian, let me go back to you, and just for men, and I'm sure, I mean, there are many different expressions of bisexuality, I'm assuming. What is the experience? What is the exploration about?
Well, again, I think one thing we have to come back to throughout our discussion today is, just as with any other population, like all people, bisexual men and women are living their lives in diverse ways. There is a wide range of different behaviors, identities, expressions of behavior. And, you know, following up on Rand's comment, I think if we're talking about self-identified, mm-hmm, bisexuality, that may be, quote unquote, more rare in men for a variety of reasons. I think some of them are social and cultural. But also, I think when we're talking about behavioral bisexuality, which is, you know, having sex with both male and female partners, and there's also transgender partners, which, you know, is another issue as well. But we find, you know, in some of the probability studies that we do, nationally representative studies of sexual behavior, and not only here in the United States, but globally, that behavioral bisexuality is actually more common than exclusive homosexuality. Huh. And I think that part of the reason why the behavior and identity may not necessarily always match, where there may not necessarily be congruence, is because these things do change. You know, people have a negative connotation that change in sexuality is a bad thing over the lifespan, but I think there's always change going on. And also, just that, I think one main point I hope we can come out with today, too, is this whole myth that it's, quote unquote, easier to identify as bisexual. I think just the recent examples in the media,
right,
show again that the backlash that people experience when they come out as bisexual. You know, we're in a different era now where I think even from 10 or 20 years ago, coming out as gay, you know, used to be something different than it is today. But coming out as bisexual, I think, is actually very challenging, because we found in our research that there is a great deal of stigma and discrimination faced by bisexual men and women, by both heterosexual and gay and lesbian individuals and communities.
Yeah. Well, have you found that to be true, Rand, from some of your patients?
I have. I think it's more challenging to come out as a bisexual man than a gay man. I mean, gay men, we have a very definite community that supports us and helps us in that coming out experience that I don't really mm-hmm. believe the bisexual men necessarily have. And we have role models that perhaps that bisexual community doesn't have as well. So yeah, I think it's true. It's very challenging.
Well, and I was in doing some homework for today's show. I looked at some comments from Dan Savage, from Andrew Sullivan as well. And I'm looking at you, Rand.
Yeah.
And, you know, not particularly complimentary
of
right. bisexuals.
Right. Well, again, I think that's the fear that you and I were talking about earlier, the possible threat that a bisexual man can produce, the idea that if a man can choose to be with a man or a woman, well, then why can't a gay man? And that kind of maybe negates the idea that it's an orientation. So I think that's a piece of it.
Yeah, and hold on one second, because Vanessa, I want to get you back in on the conversation here, because I'm wondering about, are there certain stereotypes about women who are bisexuals?
Yeah, so I think one of the dominant stereotypes around women is that women who are bisexual are going to be hypersexual, and it's really from depictions that we see in the media around sensuality between women. And there's certainly nothing wrong with being hypersexual. A lot of bisexual women are very sexual, but a lot of them are not. Some women who are bisexual may have both male and female partners at one time. Some women may have male-female partners and then male partners. Some may only have male partners or only female partners. And some may have no partners at all, right? There's so much diversity in their sexual lives that it's really problematic to label this really diverse group of women as just one thing. And that one group being just interested in sexual behavior with anybody and everybody, because that's not the case for most of these women that I've talked to. It's not about wanting to have sex with everybody, which is the stereotype. It's about wanting to engage in sexual behavior or have romantic partnerships with people, maybe despite their sex or gender, because that person is caring or smart or sexy or kind, and not necessarily because they just want to have sex with everybody, but they see past sex and gender.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about bisexuality, what it is, what it isn't. The voice you just heard is Vanessa Schick. She's an assistant professor in the Division of Management, Policy, and Community Health at the University of Texas School of Public Health, where she researches women's sexual health. Also with us, Brian Dodge. He's at the Indiana University, in fact, associate director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University, and his research focuses on men's sexual health, including male bisexuality, and Rand Faulkner, clinical social worker at the Mazzoni Center here in Philadelphia. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
This week in This American Life, one of our producers, Ben, has this friend who told him that when he, the friend, goes to a store, like, to buy a pair of shoes, he'll say to the cashier, "So is there a good guy discount? Like, you're a good guy, I'm a good guy." And he gets, like, 25% off. Ben is not the kind of person who would ever, ever try that. Until this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, back in the 60s, lesser-known soul artists didn't get much airtime in the U.S., but they became a sensation in England. Now they're getting new life on the airwaves.
I gave up everything. I loved our life. What things I possess.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Rand Faulkner, Vanessa Schick, and Brian Dodge about bisexuality. And again, this is pretty much an adult conversation. We do want to hear from you, though, at 1-888-477-9499. Brian, let me toss something back to you based on something that Rand said right before we went to the break about choice. Is bisexuality a choice?
You know, honestly, I don't know how important that really even is to this whole conversation, because, again, I think that gets back to the essence of sexuality, period. And if we were able to answer that question about, you know, human sexuality, broadly speaking, then I think, you know, we may not be having this conversation today. I think, again, as Kinsey said, back almost 60 years ago now in his early research, there's just a wide range of human sexual expression, and whether we're talking about attraction, whether we're talking about behavior, identity, fantasy, intimacy, all of these different aspects of human sexuality, there's just a wide range of different ways that people express their sexualities, and bisexuality is one of them.
I mean, should we get rid of labels? And I'm tossing that to you, Rand.
No, I agree completely. I didn't mean to say that it's a choice so much as it can be perceived as a choice. I think that's a fairly common idea in society. That's all that I was trying to say.
Right.
But yeah, I think there's a terrific wide expression of sexuality, and I think that that needs to be considered in the conversation. Absolutely.
Vanessa, you want to get in on that?
On label?
Yeah, on label.
Congruency?
Yep.
I think labels can be positive in some ways, in that if you identify in a certain way, it sometimes makes it easier to identify other people who share that sexual identity. So in a certain way, it helps create communities. But at the same time, it also keeps people out of communities. And so in some research that my research team and I have done, we've found that congruency between women's recent sexual partnering, so who they engaged in sexual behavior with, and whether it matched their sexual identity, predicted a number of sexual, mental, and physical health outcomes. Which really demonstrates the ways in which labels can be really challenging for women and for men as well.
Rand, during the break, you were telling me about various ways to think about bisexuality, behavioral, romantic. Flesh that out for us.
Well, I think it's different experiences perhaps bisexual men may have, where there's the romantic bisexuality. There's it's an identity for some folks, and then it's an attraction for others. And I think that kind of highlights the variety, the variety that can exist within that community.
Because I can imagine someone going. I can imagine. I know people that have gone through various phases where there's a certain attraction, a same sex attraction, and then an opposite sex attraction, and you know it. At that time in their life, that's
right,
what made the most
right.
sense.
I think that's a part of our development, too. As we're maturing, I think we're taking in different messages and exploring different ideas, different fantasies, like we were saying earlier on. And I think that's a part of the human experience as well. And I think that it shouldn't be thought of as a negative experience either. I think we're allowed to have, you know, the experience, certainly.
Brian, you use the word fantasy. I mean, and I would assume. I mean, there's behavior, and then there's people's fantasy life, and what do they fantasize about? Does that help us understand bisexuality?
I mean, of course, fantasy is an element of human sexuality in general, but I appreciate Rand's last comment about how he said, you know, we are, you know, sort of free to explore sexuality, and I think that's also one of the challenges. with bisexuality in particular, and you mentioned, Marty, knowing people who have had quote-unquote phases,
right.
And phases aren't necessarily a bad thing. We all go through phases at different times, and I think if people had the opportunity and were validated and understood that they could explore their sexualities, that people, probably might be more open to doing that and talking about it, because they do that already. But I think the bottom line, again, with bisexuality is we just don't talk about it.
And because what, there's shame associated with it, or a fear of reaction?
Exactly. We found that very clearly in our work with bisexual men, that they have, as Rand said, lack of community, that bisexual men have had instances, in both settings with heterosexual and with gay and lesbian peers, friends, family members, partners, etc., where they have come out as bisexual and been told, right to their face, no, you're not. You're confused. No, you're not. You don't exist. No, you're not. You're just experimenting. And again, it gets back to these stereotypes, and they can be really harmful in relationships in particular. I know people in relationships where one partner may be bisexual and the other partner is constantly worried that they're going to cheat on them with, a partner of, the other gender. And it's just as if, having a partner of any orientation, wouldn't necessarily bring along issues of infidelity. It's just these stereotypes and assumptions that we actually explored in the attitude study that hopefully we'll get a chance to touch on, that I think really came out clearly that they're still very prevalent today.
Yeah, I don't think it's uncommon for a bisexual man in a relationship to not come out in that relationship as a bisexual man.
Why would they?
Right, absolutely. Their partner will potentially reject them, and they've established some kind of community with that partner, which is in itself threatened if you were to come out. So they're kind of constantly either coming out or they're constantly putting themselves in the closet.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, as if, any partner who was heterosexual or homosexual identified, we would say, tell me every single experience you've ever had, every thought, every fantasy. Again, this whole idea of coming out and disclosure and all of these really slippery issues, and especially in public health, how they get blurred with HIV, STI risk, and other, health outcomes.
Yeah.
I think we're still trying to understand that.
Vanessa, a concern about then isolation, that people end up being isolated and all the things that can come with that?
Yeah, so a lot of the women that I talk to, even if they didn't have direct experiences that they felt like were discrimination because they were bisexual, almost none of the women knew other individuals that they felt like were like them. Who also identified as bisexual or engaged in bisexual behaviors. And so they really always felt like they were part of the out group, whether they were with individuals who were heterosexual or homosexual. They always felt like they were something different, which can be really isolating and can lead to invisibility. Because they don't want to necessarily have to come out to everyone they meet, which is kind of coming back to something that was said earlier in the conversation.
Well, and a different kind of closet, I guess,
absolutely,
Rand.
Yeah, very much so. And in my work, I think I've certainly seen the effects of being in that closet. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of shame and a lot of depression. There's a lot of compulsivity, substance abuse, again, in the work that I've done. And so I feel that the repercussions for being in the closet and for living in a society that doesn't really value that sexual experience, I think it's pretty harmful. It's pretty upsetting.
I mean, I don't want to get hung up on labels, but is it a sexual experience, a sexual orientation?
That's a great question. I think for some folks, it is definitely an identity, and then for others, perhaps not. So,
and I think it may be an identity for more people if it were validated, accepted, and again, not stigmatized and to be told that you don't exist. I think is I can't imagine really much more of a negative or deleterious impact that could have on someone. So it may explain too why, and it could explain too why people who are, you know, quote unquote, in a phase and ultimately go one way or another, you know, I know a lot of people who over time are just sort of after years and years and years of being beat down and told that they're not who they really say they are, you might ultimately say, okay, well, maybe I'm not. And again, I really, it's hard. It's hard to imagine how and where this comes from when it's directed from both heterosexual and gay and lesbian peers.
We are talking about, hold on one second. I just need to reintroduce the three of you and also give out that phone number again. We are talking about bisexuality and what it is, what it isn't, what the experience is like, and why, in many ways, bisexuals are in the closet. Brian Dodge is Associate Director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. Vanessa Schick is with the University of Texas School of Public Health, and Rand Faulkner, Clinical Social Worker at the Mazzoni Center here in Philadelphia. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Vanessa, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add to what Brian was saying about sexual labels. There's many reasons why people choose not to adopt the label bisexual. And for a lot of the women I talk to, it is because they don't want to be attached to the stereotypes that they believe to be associated with the label bisexual. But for other women and people I talk to, they felt like that label wasn't an appropriate description of their sexual lives and experiences. So I do think it's important for me to also mention that in my work, a lot of the women also had queer or transgender partners. And for that reason, they felt like bisexual wasn't the best label because it indicated only engaging in sexual behavior with male and female partners. So I just want to, I wanted to make sure to address the diversity of the sexual experiences of the women.
Go ahead, Rand.
Very much so. And that's true for men as well. I feel like we're becoming less of we're having less of a dichotomous understanding of sexuality. And I think as that happens, genderqueer, many different kinds of ways to identify sexually are coming out, and that's maybe confusing the issue sometimes for some folks as well.
That's been a critique, actually, of the concept of bisexuality since the early days, because just by virtue of the name, it implies two genders.
Right.
And we don't live in a binary world, whether it's gender, whether it's sexuality, whether it's race, ethnicity. I think it's really interesting in our attitude study that some of the most positive attitudes toward bisexuality were expressed by people who identified as biracial or multiracial.
Because they can understand about what it's like to live in several worlds, I guess.
Right.
There's a direct parallel, I think, with the experiences of people who are, you know, both and, but also shunned and cast out by both groups that are, you know, in the middle, quote unquote, in looking back at these, you know, historically sort of passing the one drop rule, the things that multiracial and biracial people have dealt with throughout history that are unique to them, they often in the general conversation get lumped under, you know, the larger racial ethnic group and not recognizing the unique experiences and lived experiences of these individuals.
Well, Maria Bello, actress, activist, you know, came out, I should say, in the New York Times, and she's quoted as saying, "My feelings about attachment and partnership have always been that they are fluid and evolving." And interestingly, the new mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio's wife, Charlaine McRae, was a lesbian for a while. So if people are, I guess, are coming out, perhaps people will get used to, I guess, the diversity of sexual identity and orientation.
And then Tom Daley.
And Tom Daley, the Olympic swimmer.
But Marty, it's interesting even how you noted that she was a lesbian for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder what that even means. You know, I wonder if a more accurate description might be that she's had a variety of different sexual behaviors and experiences and relationships, but right now she happens to be with the mayor of New York City.
Well, I understand the distinction or the difference, I guess, sort of linguistically, and perhaps that's the point of the show here, is to say just how complicated this stuff can
right,
be.
Absolutely.
And because that tells us something about human sexuality,
yes,
I'm assuming.
Does. Yes.
Let me get George from Exton to join us on Radio Times. And George, go ahead, you're on the air. Hi, George, go ahead, you're on the air. No, we don't seem to have him. Right now he says, he describes himself as saying that he has a flexible sexuality and doesn't think it needs to be labeled at all. Hmm. Do you find that with your clients, Rand?
With many of them, and I feel quite often that a desire to not be labeled has a generational factor to it. Uh-huh. I feel like many of the younger folks I've seen really are not at all attached to the idea of having a label applied to them as opposed to an older generation, which helped them, I think, feel grounded in themselves, but also helped connect them with a community.
But looking at that historically,
Brian.
Though, too, Rand, a generation ago when I was in college, I would say, you know, people were saying the same thing. The young people are eschewing these labels. They're more comfortable with being flexible. And now it's interesting that I'm on the other side of the generation, but hearing that about the young generation today. And I really wonder how many more generations do we have to go through before we start to see maybe young people again are at a certain point in their lives after being told, you know, time after time after time that they're not who they say they are, sort of going one way or the other,
right?
With, you know, and how many happy, healthy, young bisexual people could there be if, you know, we allowed them to be who they wanted to be and who they are?
Right. Vanessa, do you see generational shifts among women?
We do see that more. In surveys, that more women are reporting engaging in sexual behavior with other women. But does that mean they're engaging in it, or does that mean that they're reporting in it? We don't really know. It might just be that they feel more comfortable reporting now. I think that, you know, sexuality is diverse now. I think it's always been diverse. I think the language that we have now to describe that diversity continues to evolve, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily that different from what generations earlier used to say about their sexual lives.
Do you see that as progress, Vanessa?
I do. I think that certain labels or non-labels, such as queer, really give people room to engage in sexual behaviors that are diverse and don't necessarily label what the gender or the sex of their partner may be. So I think that it's encouraging that we have some more inclusive labels now than we once did.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, and I do want to get some callers in as well at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moscowain. Talking with Rand Faulkner, Vanessa Schick, and Brian Dodge about bisexuality, for lack of a better word. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Meadowbrook School, located in Abington Township, supports WHYY and is an independent, small-by-design elementary school for children in grades preschool through 6th. Education at Meadowbrook emphasizes a lifelong love of learning, encourages both creative and critical thinking, expands a sense of integrity, and inspires students to make a positive difference. To learn more, there is a Meadowbrook Open House on Sunday, January 26th, from 1 to 3 p.m. Registration at themeadowbrookschool.org.
While the U.S. Congress is divided and gridlocked, some states have become political monopolies where one party controls both the state legislature and the governor's office, enabling that party to push through its political agenda. On the next Fresh Air, how funding from special interest groups is making this possible. We talk with Nicholas Confessori of the New York Times. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Want to seize the economic future? Go back to the 1800s, says one Nobel Prize-winning economist.
We are still the innovation nation, but we're only a pale shadow of what we once were.
Edmund Phelps on the economic power of collective tinkering to drive innovation and growth. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with sex researchers Brian Dodge and Vanessa Schick, and with therapist Rand Faulkner. And we are talking about bisexuality. Again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me try, looks like Naoki from Bethlehem to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
It's a no guy.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. I'm Cherokee and Lenape Indian, and as far as terminology and titles, I think that's only ever been the problem as far as just labeling things and putting things in boxes. I'm 40 years old, and I've just always loved people, and I guess maybe it's my culture that it was okay just to love people, and but you just, you know, you're with the person you're with, and that's the person you're with. Whatever their body looks like, it's just an added bonus, whether it be male, female, somewhere in between. So I've never had any of these issues that I hear these people talking about, so I just wonder if it's more of a culture kind of problem as opposed to, you know, like society in general, but is it actually just like a cultural problem? Because like I said, being an American Indian, I haven't had any problems. I'm pretty happy.
Well, that's an interesting comment. You can, Brian. Go ahead, take it.
Great. Thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate that, because actually we're just now starting to branch out and do some of the work that we've been doing here in the United States. We've just collected data from behaviorally bisexual men in India, in Mumbai, and we're looking at, you know, other parts of the world too. And I think what you said is so true. It is a problem that we have here in our society in the United States, and maybe an artifact of sort of colonial Victorian, you know, views on sexuality. But when you look at other cultures around the world, including your own, there is just, I think, much less emphasis. And there's so many different contextual reasons why someone might engage, you know, have a partner of this gender or the other, or why, you know, people are in relationships, or why people have sex. And I think here in the United States, again, we are so narrow in our thinking sometimes, and you know, with the putting people in boxes, that when we look at other parts of the world, and I'm using thinking India right now, for example, believe it or not, is probably further along than we are in terms of just cultural understanding and acceptance of bisexuality.
Let me put a question to you, Rand. We got an email from Peter. If one is attracted to both men and women, is it possible to be fully sexually satisfied or fully express your sexuality in a monogamous relationship? Which I think gets to a certain view about bisexuality.
Right. I think that's highlighting the stereotype that a bisexual person cannot be in a monogamous relationship, cannot be in a romantic relationship, but is only constantly looking for sex with either gender. And I think that's a very unfair idea of what being a bisexual individual means. So absolutely, a bisexual man, woman can be in a monogamous relationship with either a man or a woman. I think that's absolutely.
Vanessa, you want to respond to that question?
Yeah, I think that for many women, it's not whether the partner is a man or a woman. I think that you know, we're placing a lot of emphasis on gender.
Right.
For a lot of bisexual men and women, the gender doesn't necessarily matter. It's whether they can be in a happy monogamous relationship if that partner is a good partner, if that partner is, you know, sweet and supportive, and, you know, they're sexually attracted to them, and all those things that matter about a partner, regardless of what their gender is. I mean, if we were focusing on another demographic characteristic, like hair color, no one would say, can you only be in a relationship with someone who's blonde if you're also attracted to brunettes? Of course you can. But as a society, we attach so much meaning to gender that it makes these conversations really complicated.
Well, Brian, you may not like my question here, but I'll ask it anyway, because it is a sort of gender-based question. But if we're talking about someone who is attracted to both men and women, do they want something different from that relationship, different from a man than they might from a woman?
Actually, I like that question.
You do? Okay. I wasn't sure. Go ahead.
I like all your questions, okay. Marty. It's been a great discussion. And honestly, I think that, people may look for and seek and find and get different things from different people within their lives. And that could possibly, you know, for some people, they may... Whatever they're seeking in that particular interaction or relationship, they may get something different, you know, with a male partner than they might with a female partner. Or, as I think Vanessa and maybe your caller mentioned, for some people, it's also that it's sort of beyond gender, that it's more about the person and the soul of the person. And so, but I do think I've heard from... we've published work on this with men that there are some men who say they get very specific things from, you know, sexual interactions with women versus sexual interactions with men. The same with relationships. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That may just be how some people are.
I wonder, too, we haven't really talked about the down low, as it's called, but Rand, let me toss that to you, the idea of sort of living a double life. And if we're talking about bisexuality, does that help us understand perhaps even the stigma that we've been talking about?
I heard Brian take a deep breath when you said
that. I know that. I'm on thin ice here, but I'm tossing it at you.
Okay.
I'm tossing it at you, Rand.
Sorry, what's the question again?
Well, it's just, the down low, was living a kind of a double life, you know,
right.
Like perhaps living as a straight person publicly and a gay person privately.
Right. Well, that's such a dynamic and challenging topic, and could probably even stand to have its own show.
We have done that, yes.
Yeah. Well, again, it's very culturally based, certainly, and it's... I feel like it can't really be connected to our topic in a way, because I feel like the implications are very, very different. The behaviors are very, very different. I think the ability to have a romantic relationship with the same sex is very challenged in that community, and the idea that it's a sexual attraction is kind of more the goal there, I guess.
Well, and we have done whole hours on it, but just, Brian, very quickly, because we do have a lot of callers here, but I guess if there is a kind of shame associated with it, then people go underground.
And, you know, one of the first studies that I did related to these issues when I was in New York City was a study on black behaviorally bisexual men, and the whole down low phenomenon was just sort of exploding at that time with Oprah and J.L. King, etc. And honestly, again, I think it is related to what we're talking about here today in a way, because it is, you know, perhaps a form of behavioral bisexuality. But I think the real issue there, again, is disclosure. And honestly, with the expectations, you know, coming from sort of the majority white heterosexual middle class society, where we might expect people to, you know, now come out, etc. Again, that's sort of really still evolving historically, and different people in different cultures may experience that differently. And also, if there's no room for someone is going to be confronted immediately with negative reactions, including physical violence, when they disclose their sexuality, they're not going to disclose their sexuality, and I don't blame them for that. So if we're going to use disclosure as an expectation of somehow, you know, being appropriate, then we're going to have to realistically do some sort of intervention where after people disclose that they may not necessarily be met with just negative reactions.
Or violence.
Violence, which is very real.
Very real.
Well,
yes.
let me get Michael from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Thank you for the great show again.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I came out as bisexual when basically the first time I heard the term, which was in the 70s. And I ran into the same, you know, you're going through a phase, you haven't made up your mind. And eventually, you know, I had marriages break up over it because I have always claimed to be bisexual and I'm not going to change who I am. And now it's just to hell with everybody else, I'm bisexual. But during this conversation with your guests, I feel that maybe the term that we should come up with is instead of bisexual, heterosexual, or transgendered, or whatever, is open sexual.
Oh, open sexual as opposed to bisexual. Well, I'm looking at you, Rand. Go ahead.
Well, if we're talking about labels, yeah, I think bisexual is loaded, and I think it's not descriptive of the community as well. So open sexuality sounds good.
But I do think it is sort of here to stay.
And yes, it is.
You know, at this point, and honestly, people do use open sexual, pansexual, heteroflexible, all of these different types of trisexual, I'll try anything once. And but at the bottom line is, again, it's going to require society, you know, sort of moving away from this dichotomous view of sexuality in order for that to be acceptable. And I really appreciate the caller, and it reminds me of a t-shirt that I had in college that said, "No, you're confused, I'm bisexual."
We have to be willing, I think, to broaden our views of sexuality and identity in order to open up that conversation.
Vanessa, I have a tweet for you. I'm a bisexual woman, and I feel that the media marginalizes my sexual identity and expects me to go full gay or full straight. Does that sound familiar to you?
It definitely does. I think that there's really, we were talking earlier about this perception that bisexuality is a phase, and it's just kind of a holding place in between someone, you know, quote unquote, making a decision. And I think that's really damaging. And there's been some great research on, instead of thinking about phases, about kind of fluidity of sexuality over time. And I think if we can all kind of hold on to this idea of people being sexually fluid in their experiences and their attractions, I think that would really allow people to have more diverse sexual experiences and to not have stigma because of it.
Let me get, looks like Melinda from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Melinda, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, folks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems that most of the conversation today has leaned more towards the notion of sexual identity, but I think it might be helpful for the listeners to distinguish sexual identity from sexual behavior and whether it may, and often the lack of incongruence between those two concepts, as well as whether it's a more accurate way of discussing these sorts of topics, particularly when we don't know somebody's sexual identity. For example, when you were speaking of the new mayor of New York City's wife, we don't know her identity, but we could describe her behaviors, for example.
Exactly. Well, that's an interesting point. Brian, sounds like you want to respond to that.
Well, Vanessa's done quite a bit of work on this, too. So I think in public health, we've known this in the early days of the HIV epidemic. We started to use the acronym MSM, men who have sex with men, instead of gay or even gay and bisexual men, because there are so many people whose behavior and identities do not necessarily match. But the problem in public health then became MSM just basically became equivalent to every sample of men in gay bars. And it wasn't until recently where people started going out and actively finding, you know, different subgroups of men who have sex with both men and women who are different from MSM. But Vanessa, I know you've done quite a bit with women.
Yeah, and I would like to add to that with, you know, we use the term MSM a lot, men who have sex with men. We also use the term WSW, women who have sex with women. And that becomes particularly challenging given that we don't really know what sex is between women, right? We don't really have it well defined. So there's so much variability there in terms of who gets included and who gets excluded.
Is that unique to women? That we don't know what...
Everyone has different, calls sex something really different, right?
But
some people can kiss somebody and say we engaged in sex.
Yeah, in public health, Vanessa, I think that, you know, with HIV, sex between men was just automatically equivocated with anal unprotected anal sex, whereas, you know, when we look at bisexual men's actual sexual behaviors, the most common sexual behaviors are vaginal intercourse and oral sex with both men and women. Anal sex is way down at the bottom. And so with women, I think it's even more so that CDC hasn't even had guidelines for women who have sex with women because they haven't known where to begin with the behaviors. And that's why Vanessa's work has been so incredible, because she's been documenting the different behaviors that people actually engage in.
Well, about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, and Rand, let me turn back to you, because you deal with patients that come in to see you. Is your goal then for them, I mean, I assume the goal for therapy is self-acceptance, is understanding yourself, understanding the struggles that you might have in your life.
Yeah, that's tremendous. Awareness is key. If somebody can be aware of their selves, their wants, their desires, I think that's very important. Accepting self, as you've said, is the goal. I think a big goal in therapy, at least. I think that goes a long way to alleviating the shame and the depression and a lot of those kind of presentations that people come in with. But I think first and foremost, if they can accept themselves, build a community that will reinforce the acceptance, I think that's very important.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Rand Faulkner, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's clinical social worker at the Mazzoni Center, which is here in Philadelphia. Vanessa Schick, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And she's assistant professor in the Division of Management, Policy, and Community Health at the University of Texas's School of Public Health, and researches women's sexual health. Brian Dodge, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Associate Director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University, and his research focuses broadly on men's sexual health. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can learn much more about this program. In fact, send us an email, join us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter as well. Let's see, Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.